to express to you some of my feelings, particularly how I feel about the gospel of Jesus Christ and the opportunity that I have to be a member of the Lord's true church. It's been 5.5 years now since I joined the Mormon church. I was raised Catholic, one of 13 children. I joined the church on December 4th, 1982. After 3.5 years of study in St. Gart's private Jesuit seminary to become a Catholic priest. This story all begins when I was about 7 years old. My dad came up to and asked me one day, "Oh, Bill, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "Well, a fireman, a policeman, an astronaut, I don't know. Something like most seven-year-olds say." And my dad said, "How about a priest?" And I was before the age of accountability, so I said, "A priest sounds like a great thing to be." And from that day forth, my parents set a goal that I would become a Catholic priest. It's a very important thing in a Catholic family, and something that meant a great deal to my parents. At age 14, an interesting event happened in my life. The Catholic Church at that time was doing a program called The Search. And what they did is they took a group of high school students and they put them in a gymnasium of a high school for 3 days to 3 weeks, depending on the program. And they took away their timepieces, darkened all the windows, and just took them away from contact with the outside world and left them to talk about the church and their relationship to God. It's much like if you've been on a mission, your MTC experience. And it was the first time in my life there that I felt the Spirit. That wonderful sensation. And I made a promise to my Heavenly Father that I was going to seek that Spirit out. And wherever I found it, that's where I would be. And that promise to my Heavenly Father is going to have a profound effect on me later when I come to study with the LDS missionaries. I went on to finish high school, and upon graduation, I enrolled in St. Gart's Seminary. At St. Gart's, my first year really went by without much event. More interesting is my second year. I noticed that some of my friends, fellow seminary students, and fathers were calling me a nickname. And the nickname was Digger. And I didn't understand that. The only Digger I was familiar with was a little dog they used to advertise on TV that you balanced and rode on at the same time. And I said, "Why do you call me that?" And one of my seminary fathers said, "Because you're a digger. You won't feed just at the surface. You want to know things deeper than most. Therefore, you're a digger." And I said, "Is that good or is that bad?" "Well, that's not particularly good. The Catholic Church believes pretty strongly in a blind faith. And I didn't simply want to teach something. I wanted to know why I was teaching it and why I believed it. And that sometimes ran as an obstacle to me." It was during my second year, I began to do a lot of personal study. And after a couple months of that, I received counsel from some of my seminary fathers that personal study was affecting my testimony. And they encouraged me to discontinue it. I didn't quite understand why. And the encouraging of them for me to stop continued. But if I was going to be a representative of the Lord and be as his ambassador and be the ecclesiastical authority for these people, I ought to know more than just what tradition taught me to believe. Well, it went to such a level that they wrote my parents and told them to discourage me in my personal studies, or it would affect my stay. So what I decided to do was to make my personal study more of a private thing. I started doing it late at night after everyone else had retired, generally 1 or 2 in the morning. And one night I remember particularly, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was studying in Matthew, the 3rd chapter. And if you're familiar with that chapter, there's 17 verses, and it talks about the baptism of Jesus Christ at the hands of John the Baptist. And I read those last verses, 13 to 17, And I felt a most overwhelming spirit. I didn't really understand what I was to learn from it, but I knew that there was something there that the Lord wanted me to know. And it talks about where Jesus Christ was immersed underwater, and he went straightway out of the water. And the Holy Ghost descended in the sign of a dove, an Old Testament sign given that John the Baptist would know that he baptized the Son of God. And the voice of God the Father speaking from the heavens, saying, "Behold, this is my beloved Son, hear ye him." And I would spend about the next 2 hours just going over those four verses over and over again. And it was about 4:15 in the morning. It was like someone turned on a light in a dark room. The Spirit just came in. And for the first time in my life, the Spirit taught me something. I knew then, and in an instant, that God the Father and Jesus Christ were two separate beings. And the doctrine of the Trinity that I'd been taught all my life was false. I was so excited. I was only 19 at the time. I thought, well, everyone would be interested in this great discovery I've made. So the next day at seminary, we have an auditorium which had about 200 seats, and in the front it had 13 leather seats, and that's where the seminary fathers sat up front. And we had kind of a gospel sharing time where the different seminary students would share their ideas and feelings. And we had about 20 minutes left, and I stood up. And I remember Father Schmidt, who sat on the end, recognized me and announced my name. And I took a deep breath, and I said, "I'd like to share with you what I've learned by the study of the Scriptures, and by the power of the Spirit, I know that God the Father and Jesus Christ are two separate beings, and the doctrine of the Trinity is a false doctrine." Well, I was expecting something more like the Hosanna shout, but I would guess the best gospel analogy would be the stoning of Stephen. It didn't go over well. I remember Father Schmidt, he rose again. He pointed his finger at me and he said, "Young man, that's a damnable heresy, if not blasphemy." And I was a little taken back by that. I didn't know how to react, but I reacted in the wrong way, believe me. I didn't like necessarily being attacked for what I had been taught of the Spirit, so I made a comment to him, something on the lines of, "You old codger, you wouldn't know the Spirit if it beat you about the head and shoulders." He didn't like that at all. Well, I would spend a lot of time in his office the next couple weeks in counseling as to whether I would continue my stay at St. Gart's. They gave me an ultimatum. They said, "Brother Carpenter, you can denounce what you said to that class and continue your stay, or you can take your belief and walk with it." Now, that was a difficult decision for me, based upon the fact that my parents, this was their dream. And I don't know what you know about Catholic seminary, but at the institution that I was studying at, being a private school, my parents had invested a little over $12,000 a year to have me there. So this was a substantial investment on their part. And I had a big decision to make. My parents' wants influenced me greatly, and I decided that I would go before those students, denounce what I said, and continue in my studies. I did, but I noticed in and of myself that my spirit had been kind of broken, and I didn't have the zeal that I had before. I finished my third year. Your third year in Catholic seminary is important, particularly if you study under the order of the Jesuit, because your fourth year, which I was about to begin, was your cloister year. And that was a 365-day vow of silence. That was a year in which you were not spoken to or you were to speak. And that has an interesting effect on me. If you get to know me very well, you know that I have a really hard time shutting up, let alone not speaking for a year. And they give you a sabbatical to prepare yourself for that time, a 3-month religious leave. And I decided that that's what I would do. I'd take my sabbatical and then sign my final papers and have my induction into my last years of seminary. On leaving St. Gart's for that sabbatical, with the Catholic Church to gain an ecclesiastical authority, seminary is a 7-year program. You graduate with a degree in philosophy and theology. And I was 2 of my philosophy courses behind, so I decided I would go to the University of Idaho and pick them up during that semester break that I had. And then I would come back. University of Idaho being just a few miles from my parents' home. I went there, and it was kind of interesting. My landlord was a Mr. Steele, and somehow he had learned that I had just left St. Gart's. And he felt it his moral obligation as a good Catholic man to warn me that my 2 roommates were Mormons. And I wasn't too worried. But I remember my first encounter with my roommate. He was coming down the stairwell, and he was a big man. He was probably 6'2", 235 pounds, and he just completely filled his stairwell. And I'm a little bit, cocky, I guess. And I was coming up the stairs, and I said, "I'm a Catholic, you're a Mormon, you don't try to convert me, and I won't try and convert you." And this big guy just grinned from ear to ear and walked right on past me, and he got to the bottom of the stairs and he laughed. I'm going, that's odd. It's kind of funny. I talked to him later after I joined the church, and I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "Well, Bill, because there was a few things that you didn't know about me at that time. One was that Mark had just returned off a mission about 6 months earlier. I didn't know what it meant to challenge a returned missionary, but he set it in his mind that day to let me find out what it was." And the other was the fact that I would grow to love him very much, and we'd become very close friends. Mark had waited to go on his mission quite a bit longer than the average missionary. Mark didn't go till he was 26. And he just recently returned. He was a very good missionary. And when I say he was a very good missionary, I guess I sometimes think that good missionaries are also sneaky missionaries, and sneaky is what he was. He learned quickly about me and realized that I had something of an ego, and he could use it against me. I remember studying up on the 3rd floor, and he'd come up, and he'd ask me some doctrinal question. And he'd say, "Now, you spent almost 4 years in seminary. Your answer to this would probably be far more complete than anything that I could come up with. So why don't you tell me what you think about this?" And just pat my ego enough that I would expound some little doctrinal statement, exhaust all my ideas, give this 45-minute dissertation. And he'd sit there very patiently and quietly and just listen. And when I'd finish, couldn't think of anything else to say. He'd say, "Well, that's very interesting, Bill. Have you ever thought about it this way?" And he'd speak for only a couple minutes, but share some little bit of Mormon knowledge. And he'd say, "You think about that." And then he'd get up and leave. And, oh, it used to drive me nuts. Because he entrapped me at least 10, 20 times this way. And he'd just share his little bit of information, then he'd say, "Think about it," and he'd leave. I was just about to finish there, and Mark was about to graduate. We both had about a month left. And one night he came up to me and he said, "Bill, I'd like to give you my most valuable possession." And Mark had a car that I coveted. I mean, really. And I thought, wow, what a deserving child of a generous God. He's going to give me this car. And I could picture myself, you know, the wind in my hair, driving Mark's car. And he said, "I'd like to share with you my testimony of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." I said, "No car." But he bore the sweetest, purest testimony. And I felt the Spirit really strong. And when he finished, he said, "I want you to think about that." And he left. And he did leave me thinking, without a doubt. I'd be up half that night going through my mind. I remember counseling with God saying, okay, God, I felt the Spirit in a Catholic search, and then I felt it in a doctrine that goes completely contrary to everything that I've been taught, and it got me into a lot of trouble. And now I feel it coming from Mormons. We got to work out some kind of consistency here, because you're really fooling me here. But I learned something important later on in life, and that is when the Spirit speaks to you, you have to act on it. Because if you don't, it departs and opens up your agency. And I didn't act fast enough, and soon my mind began thinking about other things. At this point, my parents' investment in my seminary education was a little over $40,000. This was their dream. And what was I doing? I had a month left before going back. They'd been planning this day for some time. I got scared. I didn't say goodbye to Mark. I just left the university and took a job. Now, I'll give you a little word for the wise. If you want to run away from the Mormons, I do not recommend Southern Idaho. They'll hunt you down, I promise. I took a job in Southern Idaho with a man by the name of Mike Patton. And I'd been with him about 2 hours, and he came up to me and he said, Bill, you just said you came from the University of Idaho, and I said, yes, and he goes, I have a friend that goes there. His name's Mark Holbrook. By chance, do you know him? I'm thinking, 9,000 students, and this guy knows the only guy I know. And I said, no, never met him. I just didn't want any of that past with me at that time. And he goes, well, it is a big place. I worked for Mike for about 2 weeks. And then one day he came up to me after work and he said, Bill, I feel impressed to tell you something. I want to go, oh, gosh, not an impressed Mormon. He said, I feel impressed that you ran away from something. And I think you ought to find out what it was. Something very important. I'm going, buddy, I didn't tell you a thing. I don't know where you Mormons get this communication, but... He says, I'll give you a week off if you want to find out what it is you ran from. So I got to thinking, well, Mormons, small sect who live in the mountains of Utah, wear black hats, have beards, have lots of wives. Can't be more than 500 of them. Who needs a week to find out him? I could take one day, find out a little information about the Mormons, have 6 days to play. So I said, okay, I'll go up and find a little bit out about what I ran away from. Didn't give him any idea as to what I was going to go investigate. I was at that time in Caldwell, and the distance between Boise or Caldwell to Moscow is about a 6-hour drive by car. But I hadn't brought my car down, so I had to take the bus. And I don't know if you've ever traveled by bus, but what would take you 6 hours takes you 14. And because they stop in every little non-existent community along the way, and believe me, Idaho has more than its share of little non-existent communities. I remember getting back on a Sunday morning. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, the best way probably to learn about the Mormons is to go to church. I don't want to go to Mark's ward because I don't want anybody to know me. But I knew there was another college ward that met there. And I went in, and they hand me this little program. It says it's fast and testimony meeting. And I kind of saunter into this, what looks like a chapel, and I sit down in the middle of this place and start looking around. And I see basketball hoops. Now, they don't have basketball hoops in Catholic chapels. Well, so Mormons have basketball hoops in their chapels. There's no altar, no big starburst behind it, no statues. And I'm waiting here patiently for somebody to come conduct this meeting. And having been raised 21 years now Catholic, authority to conduct a meeting means you wear long flowing robes and you're an old Irish man from... And finally, this young man steps up to the podium. He can't be more than 2 years older than I am. His acne hasn't cleared up. And he begins to conduct this meeting. And he opens it to testimonies to the congregation. Well, we as Latter-day Saints ought to have a certain requirement placed upon us, and that is, if the ward went to the temple the day before, it ought to be on the program, because it's not fair to the unsuspecting visitor who sits in the congregation. This ward had went to the C.L. Washington Temple the day before, and I sat there mesmerized as 17 youth my own age got up and just sobbed about a place that they'd just been to. And I just felt the Spirit stronger than I ever have before. The Spirit's an interesting thing. It's the ultimate warm fuzzy. It's the only time in your life that you can have hot flashes and goosebumps at the same time. And I'm just soaking all this in, listening to these people. And then I start thinking about other things, you know, about my parents' investment, about my parents' plans. And I got scared. And I got up to leave. And all of our chapels are the same. We always have those doors with the bar that you have to hit to get out. And I remember hitting that bar as I was about to leave. And for the first time in my life, and I have to assume it was an audible voice because I heard it, the Spirit spoke to me and said, "You promised me. You spent 21 years looking for me, and each time you felt me, you ran." And I stopped, and I looked around, and there was no one there. And again, the same voice, "You promised me. You spent 21 years looking for me, and each time you feel me, you run." And then I remembered the promise I had made when I was 14 at that first search. And about the time I felt a hand on my shoulder, it scared me to death. Turned around, and there was a little man who would later turn out to be my bishop, and he said, "You really don't want to go. Why don't you come sit with me?" And I did, and sat through the remainder of the meetings. Had a lot to think about when I came home. Finally, I found the number of two LDS missionaries, an Elder Ballard and an Elder Thompson. I'd met them that day at church. One was from Pocatello, Idaho, serving in Moscow, Idaho. The other was from San Diego, California. And I remember dialing that number, and the voice on the other end of the phone says, "Hello, this is Elder Ballard, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint Missionaries. What may I do for you?" And I said, "Hello, Elder Ballard, this is Bill Carpenter. I'm a Catholic seminary student. I'd like to learn a little bit about your church." And he laughed. He said, "Oh, Brother Carpenter, what can we do for you?" And I'd met these two young men that day at church, and they assumed I was a member. And I said, "No, young man, I'm a Catholic seminary student, and I'd like to learn a little bit about your church." And then the phone goes really quiet. And a few moments later, another voice is on the phone. "Hello, this is Elder Thompson. Mr. Carpenter, what can we do for you?" And I later learned that Elder Ballard had been out 3 weeks, and he was a little overwhelmed, so the trainer took the phone. And Elder Thompson was very professional, and he invited me to hear a discussion this Tuesday at 7:30. And I went there. Saw two young men, white shirts, dark ties, dark slacks, short hair, same first name. And the first discussion then was called Our Acceptance of Christ. And it teaches that God the Father and Jesus Christ are two separate beings. And as Elder Ballard explained this to me, I stopped him and I said, "Where did you learn that?" And he said, "I learned it in primary." And I said, "Oh, what's primary?" And he said, "Well, that's where we teach the children of the church." Okay, I'm a little offended by that statement. It took me 21 years. And I said, "No, you don't understand. That's my truth. I discovered that." And I explained this situation that I've just previously explained in the seminary to them. And Elder Thompson stops me. He goes, "No, Bill, that's not your truth. It's God's, and we probably ought to let him have it." And I said, "Well, that's fantastic, though. There's three of us who believe this." And he goes, "Well, the three of us and 6 million Mormons." I'm going, "Oh, wow, I can't believe this." And they finished this discussion. And I said, "You guys are amazing." I said, "I don't know how long you went to seminary, but you were there a lot longer than I was, because I didn't learn any of this stuff." And I said, where'd you go? And Elder Ballard goes, well, we went to the MTC. And I said, so what's the MTC? And he goes, that's the Missionary Training Center. I said, well, what? You were there 5-6 years. And he goes, no, we were there 3 weeks. I go, you can't learn the fullness of the gospel in 3 weeks. I didn't learn any of this stuff, and I was there almost 4 years. Mm-hmm. And Elder Thompson then decides just to put a little whipped cream on the top of this great dessert they've dished up, and he says, well, 9 weeks if you have to learn a foreign language. And I go, wow, the fullness of the gospel in a foreign language in 9 weeks. This is a pretty impressive place. I remember at the end of this discussion, though, I said, well, you do understand, though, I'm Catholic. And Elder Ballard and Elder Thompson looked at each other, smiled, and laughed. And I thought, that's strange. And I asked him, why? They laughed, and he said, Mr. Carpenter, we've so seriously fractured your testimony of your past belief that you are only said that to justify it back to yourself. And I thought about that. And when I served my mission, that was one of my favorite statements. At the end of a discussion, someone would say, well, I'm Baptist. A little thought would come through my mind. Well, we so seriously fractured your testimony. You have to justify it back to yourself. They invited me back that Thursday. Same place, same time. And if I'd have spent the next 10 years of my life preparing for that discussion, I'd never have been prepared. I know what the plan of salvation means to someone who's never heard it. I sat in the presence of 2 19-year-old men who answered the greatest questions of all time, the greatest thinkers of all time. Plato, Aristotle, Socrates had given their queries as to what the meaning of man's existence is, what his relationship to God is, and what death brings. But I sat in the presence of 2 19-year-old men who knew. At that time, I'd felt the Spirit stronger than I ever have in my life. And as Elder Ballard was teaching me this, we were about halfway through the discussion, and he looked at me, and he said, do you feel the Spirit? And I said, I do, very strong. And he said, so do I. He said, that is the Spirit that the Lord uses to invite men to obey his commandments. And one of the Lord's primary commandments is that we are baptized. He said, Bill, will you be baptized a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? He was the picture of power. The mantle of God had fallen upon that young man. He looked precious. But I wish I had a camera for the expression on his companion's face. Elder Thompson was the trainer, and you could see what was going through his mind. He's thinking, Greeny, we haven't taught him about Joseph Smith. We haven't taught him about the Book of Mormon. You mess this up, and I'm going to get you. When he asked me that, before I could even think, I already had given a response. I said, I can't this week, but I can next week. And Elder Thompson would like to have just passed out. And then I realized what I'd said. And I grunted like I was going to retract the statement. And Elder Ballard, 3 weeks out, he stood up and he pointed his finger at me. And he said, in this church we listen to the Spirit. God's been trying to teach you that for a long time. We'll take the first answer, thank you. I couldn't believe it. My green missionary had rebuked me. And he was right, though. And we set up my baptism for December 4th, 1982. Oh, I came home. I was on cloud nine. I couldn't believe it. I'd found the true church. I was going to get baptized. It was exciting. And this thought kept coming to my mind. Well, December 4th, 1982, you're supposed to do something. Oh, I can't remember what it is. It couldn't be that important anyway. And this happened for about the next 3-4 hours. And then finally it was about 10:30 at night. And I realized what I was supposed to do on December 4th, 1982. That was the day of my induction back in the seminary. My parents had been planning this event for almost 3 years now. This was a big event. And they didn't know anything about this. Have you ever went through that scenario where you dial the first 6 numbers of a phone number and never quite get the seventh number before you hang up. I must have did that 20 times before it ever rang at my parents' house. And finally, my mom answered the phone. And I said, "Hello, Mom, this is Bill." And she goes, "Bill, I'm so glad you called. Today I talked to Bishop Sylvester Trinan, and he's going to speak at your induction into seminary." Believe me, having Bishop Trinan speak at my induction in the seminary is like having President Benson speak at your missionary farewell. He's a very important man, and a very important man to my family. And my mom goes on and talks about everything that's going on, you know, who's going to give talks, who's going to give prayers, what items are going to be blessed. She describes everything down to the napkins. And her closing statement is, "This is the proudest day in the life of your father and I." I
didn't know what to do.
And I hadn't said anything so much. She'd talked for about 20 minutes, and I hadn't said anything. So she said, "Something's wrong." And my mom is so wonderful. She's so naive. She said, "You don't like the napkins, do you?" And I said, "No, Mom, it's not the napkins." She goes, "Well, there's something wrong. I sense it. What is it?" "I'm going to be baptized a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on December 4th instead of going back into the seminary." Long, awkward pause. My mom said something on the lines of, "Oh my gosh, what are we going to tell your dad?" I said, "I don't know, let me speak to him." She said, "No, I'll tell him." I was eager to procrastinate the day of my repentance. I said, "Go ahead." And I was supposed to call him back, but I put it off for about 10 days. It was about 2 days before my baptism. I finally got up enough nerve, and I called him back. And I said, "Hello, Mom, I'd like to invite you and Dad to attend my baptism." She goes, "No, I don't think that would be an event we plan on attending." I said, "Well, I understand, but I'd like to invite Dad personally if I may." She goes, "I'm afraid that's impossible." I said, "Why?" "Because I haven't told him yet." "Oh." I said, "Mom, I'm not going to do this behind his back." She goes, "Well, I don't think it's something you should tell him over the phone. Why don't you drive home? I will have told him, and you can discuss it with him in person." So I got in my car and drove home. And I remember driving into my parents' driveway and seeing my dad standing in front of the window and his arms are crossed. And for the first time in 21 years, I ever saw my dad cry. And my dad's not just not an emotional man, and it completely unnerved me. I remember coming up to the house and getting to the door, and in front of the door were my suitcases. And on my largest suitcase was a note from my dad that said, "If you want to be a carpenter, you'll be Catholic. If you want to be a Mormon, you'll take these and go. But as soon as you step out of this house, this family goes from 13 to 12. I didn't know what to do. I just sat down on my suitcases and I cried. I was there for about 40 minutes when my dad came out, and he just shook his head and he said, "Take them and go." He said, "But you are not a part of this family, and we won't have anything further to do with you." I loaded up my suitcases and the back of my car and drove to my missionary's house, and I went to him and I said, "Elish, I can't do this. I love my parents too much. I can't hurt them in the way I'm about to. They've sacrificed for me all my life, and I can't do this to them." And they sat down with me and spoke to me, said, "I know you love your parents." He says, "But there's something you have to understand about love. The greatest act of love was a father willing to separate himself from a son so that others could be blessed. Love requires sacrifice. Bill, you could not make this choice and tell your family for a lifetime that you loved them by honoring what they didn't want you to do. Or you can do this and in all reality tell them you love them for eternity. The choice is yours." And they left me to think about it. I don't know why Mormons do that, but we do. And I thought about it and prayed about it, and my decision was made. I'd rather have my family know I love them for eternity than for the duration of a short lifetime. On December 4th, 1982, I was baptized in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It was a sweet experience, and one I will not soon forget. I guess the funniest part of that day was when Mike met Mark at my baptism, and he came up to me and he said, "You liar, you know him." I said, "Well, that's okay. I repented before I was baptized, so you can't hold me accountable to those things." The day after that baptism, my elders came over and told me that they would be transferred. Oh, gosh, I didn't want to say goodbye. I think I loved them more than I did any two people at that time. But I understood something about them. They had been there for me, and I would never stand in the way of letting them be there for someone else if they had been for me. I hugged them and I said goodbye. A few days later, Mark graduated from the University of Idaho, and I found myself alone in a dormitory. No family to go home to for the holidays, thinking this is not going to be much of a Christmas season. But I learned one of the greatest lessons of my lifetime during those 3 weeks. The Lord knew something that I didn't know. That was, I would have used those men as crutches. But if I was going to make it through the next year, my testimony had to be my own. And when that time was up, it was mine. I knew it because God taught it to me through the Spirit of the Lord, and not because someone else had influenced me. I could stand behind what I believed. I started preparing for a mission, which was the promise I made to my elders the night I was baptized, that I wanted to put something back into those white shirts and ties. And I wanted that title, Elder. My parents had forbid any members of my family to speak with me or to see me. About 3 months passed. One day I got a letter from my youngest sister, Laura, and it said that my parish priest had spoken in church, and he'd spoken about me. And he said that I was a child of the devil, and that they weren't supposed to have any interaction with me. Laura said, "I didn't believe that, but I asked Dad, and Dad said it was true." And she told me that would be the last time I heard from her. That one hurt, but I had a very good bishop and some wonderful home teachers that helped me pass that time. 9 more months passed. I was a member 11 months then. I received a call to the Iowa-Des Moines mission. Ironically, I also received a call from my mom that night. My mom said, "I think we need to have a talk." After 11 months, all I could say was, "Amen. I think it's about time." I learned a great deal of gospel knowledge in that time, but wisdom wasn't one of them. If your parents don't speak to you for 11 months, I don't recommend in your first sentence as you walk into their home to tell them that you're going on an LDS mission. It will probably take them another 7-8 months to get over that statement before they speak to you again, and so was the case. At 13 months, I entered the Missionary Training Center, the most fantastic experience of my life. It was like 3 weeks in paradise. We figured it out one day, why that place was so wonderful. There were almost 3,000 missionaries there when we were there, and we counted between companion prayers, morning prayers, evening prayers, opening prayers, closing prayers, district prayers, every other kind of prayer that you can imagine we had during the course of the day, and it came out to be about 15 prayers per individual. So 15 prayers, 3,000 missionaries on about a 7.5-acre plot, 45,000 prayers. The Lord could do anything He wanted there. Not to mention the fact that we were mentioned in the temple every day.
that our families prayed for us, our friends prayed for us, and people that we didn't know or didn't even know our message literally prayed for us in our message. And it was a fantastic experience. The only bad thing about the MTC is the fact that when you leave and your plane dips below the clouds of your mission, you forget everything we teach you there. And it doesn't come back for a couple weeks. I remember landing in my mission. And I think it's a church law or something. To be a mission president, you have to have gargantuan hands. And I remember shaking hands with my mission president, afraid I was just going to get lost in there. Only thing bigger than a mission president's hand is their heart. And they literally become your mom and your dad. You counsel with your mission president like you would your father. And your mom, she's just a ray of sunshine. She's just always so wonderful and so happy to see you. I remember the morning I was to leave, speaking with my mission president. And I said, "Well, president, where am I going?" And he said, "You're going to Sheraton." Now, I know where Des Moines is, and I know where Dubuque is, and I know where Ottumwa is, because that's where radar's from on MASH. And I said, "Where's Sheraton?" And he said, "Well, it's about 23 miles north of the Missouri border." And I know enough church history, I didn't want to go anywhere near Missouri. And I go, "Well, tell me about the ward." He said, "There's no ward." "So tell me about the branch." "There's no branch." "President, tell me, we got a member." He says, "I'm sorry, Elder Carpenter, but that's why we're sending you there." I go, "Well, where do we go to church?" And he goes, "We go to church in Osceola." "Where in the world's Osceola?" "30 miles east of Sheraton." I said, "President, you wanted me to have people drive 60 miles to come to church?" He said, "Yes. Because it's true, you understand." And, oh, I go, "Wow. Anything else I should know about this place?" He said, "Well, there's 2,300 people who live in Sheraton, and there's 27 churches." Oh, wonderful. And then we went in and he said, "Elder Carpenter, I'd like you to set a baptismal goal." And I said, "Well, I'd like to have 10 my first year, President." And he said, "That's a very lofty goal." And I go, "Why's that?" And he said, "Because the mission average is 0.8 baptisms per missionary every year." 0.8 baptisms. I want to know what that is. Is that a one-armed man? He said, "But if you have faith, I believe you can do it." Well, we went to Sheraton, and I went with my trainer's name was Elder Budge, and he was from this little town called Harlowton, Montana. Never heard of it? Well, neither has anyone else. And Elder Budge, oh, bless his heart, he was so interesting personality that first night we were there, he asked me, he said, "Elder Carpenter, will you give our companion prayer?" And I was so excited, I wanted to impress my trainer. He and I knelt down and I folded my arms and closed my eyes. And I thought for a couple of minutes because I wanted this to be a really good prayer. And finally I knew what I wanted to say. And I said, "Our dear Heavenly Father," and Elder Budge has moved behind me and he answers very loudly in my ear, "Yes." I thought God was in the room. He'd like to have clawed me off the ceiling. I was so scared. Well, Elder Budge is going to become famous for that little act because he'll share it in his own conference about a month later. But he was a spiritual giant. I remember the first day we came out, and we bought a map. And I thought, being a good missionary, I'd go in there and I'd draw sections in my map, you know, like all good missionaries, sections 1 through 7. And he came out of the bathroom from brushing his teeth and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm drawing sections in the map. You know, I'm organizing the town." He says, "Elder Carpenter, that's an apostate Christian belief and we don't do that."
accent.
I don't know what you're talking about. He said, well, think of it this way. How long is it going to take to do Section 1? I said, well, probably a month or so. And he said, and how long before we get to Section 7? I said, probably 3-4 months. And he said, Elder Carpenter, let's suppose the elect person lives in Section 7. By the time we get there, they've moved to Dallas and someone else has baptized them. Now, we don't want that to happen to us. So what we're going to do is we're going to pray about this. And we're going to go where the Lord wants us to go. I said, great, that sounds exciting, Elder Budge. I think talking by the Spirit sounds like a good idea. And he said, good, go pray. And tell us where we're going to go. Oh, I was so scared. I must have spent 40 minutes at this map. Finally, I come back and I go, okay, we're going to go to the northeast corner of town. And he goes, oh, Elder Carpenter, that's wonderful. I can see that you received some inspiration there. And I said, well, thank you. And he goes, but there's at least 17 streets in the northeast corner of town, and that's a little general. Could you go back and get a particular street? I said, I can't believe it. He wants me to get a street. So I spend about another 30, 40 minutes at this map. Finally, I say, 19th northeast. Please help me, Lord. And so we take off and head across town, get to this 19th northeast. The Lord has welcomed us to Iowa with about 2 feet of new snow. And we start knocking on doors. And I learned this new thing. People in Iowa don't open the door. They go to the window and rub off a frost spot big enough so that you can see their face and their lips move when they say, it's too cold, go on, to open the door. And I'm going, you're telling me, buddy, I'm the one that's freezing. And we go down this entire one side of the street and no one lets us in, and I'm getting pretty discouraged. We start up the other side and we make it about halfway. Walk past this house and it's been in a fire. And I know that people don't live in burned-out houses, so I go on by, and the Spirit says, knock on a burned-out house, and I'm going, silly Spirit, people don't live in burned-out houses. We're going up to the next house, and Elder Budge grabs my hand before I knock on the door, and he says, what are we supposed to be doing? I said, for goodness sake, I don't know, knock on the burned out house. And he said, good, I didn't think that could be right. So we go back and we knock on this house. And this lady opens the door. She invites us in. So in Iowa, people live in burned out houses, I don't know. And she introduced herself and says her name's Ruthie King. And we start to teach her. Oh my gosh, it's so cool. The Spirit is really strong, and I, being new and kind of excited, I thought, well, it worked for my greenie. It'll work here. So in the middle of Elder Budge's principle, I said, so do you want to get baptized? More precious than Thompson's face was Elder Budge when Sister King said, yes, I would, and so would my 3 daughters. I was so excited. I mean, that was 4 baptisms. I just wanted to call my mission president and go, neener, neener, president, that's 4. But working with Elder Budge and in Sheraton was a wonderful experience. And time passed. When I got transferred to Carroll. Carroll has 13,000 people and 12,500 Catholics. And I knew why they transferred me there. I was training my second missionary there. And one night about 11:30, the phone rang. And it was my mom. And I said, Mom, how'd you get this number? And she said, your mission president gave it to me. And I said, oh, why are you calling? And she said, your dad went in to have an angioplasty. And doing the angioplasty, he suffered 2 massive coronaries. They don't think he's going to make it. Father has been here and given him his last rites. We want you to come home. I fell apart. My greenie had never seen his trainer fall apart, so we fell apart together. And my dad didn't pass away that night, but he'd be in and out of consciousness for the next couple weeks. And finally, I'd heard from all my brothers and sisters with the same question. If you believe in eternal families, or if the family's the most important unit of the gospel, then what are you doing to your own?
why aren't you where you're supposed to be?
The next day I called my mission president and told him that I wanted to go home. I wanted this opportunity to see my family and maybe correct some of the things that I had done. He got me an airplane ticket for the next day. I remember about 6 o'clock that morning, the phone rang and it was my mission president. He said, "Oh, Lieutenant, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to straight out ask you. The Lord wants you to extend your mission 6 months beyond the 18 months you are currently called to serve." And I got upset. I said, "President, I can't believe you call and ask me to do that today. After you know what I've been through and that I'm going home today." And I hung up the phone. Sometime later, the phone rang again. This time, it was my mom. And my mom said that during the night that my dad had regained consciousness and that he'd been insisting to speak with me. And they weren't going to allow him to because of his ill health, but his insisting persisted. And next thing I knew, I was talking to my dad on the phone. And I told him I was coming home and Tim was going to pick me up at the airport. He said, "No, I don't want you to." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you just don't have anything to come back here to." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, we really just don't want you back." And I said, "That's not enough, Dad." I said, "You tell me why, or else I'm going to come home today." And we discussed that for a little while, and finally he said, "Okay, I'll tell you." He says, "I don't understand it." But he said, "Last night before I came to, someone spoke to me, and I have to assume it was the Lord. And he said, if my life was to be sustained, we were to allow you to remain upon your mission and offer no more objection in your church." I couldn't believe what I heard. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe what my dad had said. I got off the phone with him and called my mission president back, and my mission president began to apologize. He said, "Holy Carpenter, it wasn't fair for me to ask you to do that." And I said, "No, President, you don't understand something." And I explained to him what had just happened with my dad. And my mission president and I shared a very tender moment. And he said, "But Holy Carpenter, as your mission president, I can give you 3 weeks extension. The General Missionary Board of the Church can give you 2 months. But I can't give you 6. That was half my hesitation in calling you. I don't know how I can fulfill that promise that the Lord's made to you." It was about a week, 2 weeks later that my mission president got notification from Salt Lake that 18-month proselyting elders would have the opportunity to extend their mission to 24 months. It was during those last 6 months of my mission, as wonderful as all my mission was, that I probably learned my most important lesson. One day, my companion and I were tracking. I was serving in East Des Moines. And we knocked on his house. And no one answered, and we knocked again, and still no one answered. And as we started to walk away down the sidewalk, we heard very faintly behind us the voice of a woman. It said, "No, boys, don't go." And we turned around to see in the doorframe an elderly black woman, probably in her late 70s, beckoning for us to come back. She invited us in, introduced herself as Luetta Fry. Luetta was very lonely, and she desperately wanted someone to talk to, just someone to listen to her words. And I learned early on in my mission that to teach people the gospel, many times you have to answer their needs, whether they're physical or spiritual, before you can prepare them adequately to receive the gospel. And for about an hour, we just listened to her, and she just talked, shared memories of her life and about her husband who'd passed away. And when she finished, she just sighed really heavy, and she said, "Okay, do you have something to share with me?" We taught her the first discussion and placed with her a Book of Mormon and a reading assignment.
We didn't make a return appointment. About 2 weeks passed, and I felt really impressed one day that we should go back and see her. And we did, and again, the same scenario. For the first hour, she just talked, and we didn't say anything. When she finished, she'd sigh, and she said, "Okay, I'm ready to listen." And I asked her, I said, "Luetta, did you get a chance to read in the Book of Mormon like we asked you to?" And she goes, "Yes, I read some." I said, "Well, what did you think?" She goes, "Well, I understood boys... the Sermon on the Mount better in Third Nephi than I did in the Bible." I said, "Well, that's great. That's what the Book of Mormon does. It, you know, it helps confirm the Bible. And anything else?" She goes, "Well, no. Well, I did read about a people I'm not sure I understand. They were called the Jaredites. Now, are they the people that were scattered at the time of the Tower of Babel?" My companion and I smile at each other. We know that the Jaredites are not in 3rd Nephi. And that's where the reading assignment was. So we explained to her that they indeed are. Third time's a charm. Anything else, Luetta? "Well, no, I don't think. Well, again, I read about two boys. Now, their dad's a prophet. Their brother's a righteous man. God even sends an angel to them." And she kind of threw her arms up and she said, "Oh, you can't teach some kids anything." And we laughed, and I knew who those boys were. That was Laman and Lemuel. And they weren't 3rd Nephi either. So I said, "Luetta, how much did you read?" And the sweetest memory of my mission was that elderly woman picking up the Book of Mormon off the coffee table, holding it to her bosom and saying, "I read it. I read all of it. And I loved it." And it was just a beautiful experience for us. We challenged her to baptism, and she accepted. Teaching Luetta was so much fun. She was like a child in a candy store. She wanted everything, and she wanted it now. And she had a friend who worked at the bank, and she had to write up this little contract and that we were her adopted grandchildren. And as her adopted grandchildren, we had certain contract obligations to Luetta. One was that we have to come listen to her stories, drink her hot chocolate, and eat her cookies that she made for us. And she had it notarized, and we signed it at the bottom, and it was a binding contract. And her baptism was, it was a lovely experience. Because of Luetta's frail condition, we found out that she was 83. And she would probably weigh maybe 100 pounds. We both got into the waters of baptism with her, and I remember raising her up out of the water, and she was crying. And she embraced us, and she said, "It's done. 83 years, and it's done." We went over the next day, and we explained to her visiting teaching and home teaching, told her she'd want to set a goal to go to the temple, explained some other things to her, and my companion said, "Luetta, you'll want to get a patriarchal blessing." She goes, "What's that?" He explained it as the blueprint for spiritual life. And she goes, "Oh, I want one of those blueprint things." And Luetta was just kind of an insistent, dogmatic lady, and she wouldn't let us leave that day until we contacted the bishop and the stake patriarch and made an appointment for her so she could get a blueprint. And we got an appointment for her, and a couple weeks after that appointment, we'd been visiting her every day for about 20 minutes. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. The phone rang, and it was Luetta, and she said, "Are you coming over today, boys?" And I said, "Yeah, we are. You know we are. We'll come over about 2 like we always do." And she said, "Oh, no, that won't do." I said, "What? Why won't it do?" And she said, "Because it came." I said, "What came?" She goes, "The blueprint came." The blueprint. The blessing. Oh, well, that was kind of quick. She goes, "I want you to come over this morning." It was about 9, so he said, "Yeah, we'll be there about 9:30, okay?" We went over to Luetta's house, and Luetta's house is like every grandma's house in Iowa. It's just cluttered to the ceiling with a whole lifetime of memories.
And she's got this overstuffed couch and this overstuffed chair, and she sits in that big wingback chair and just about disappears. And she's got one little ratty dog who would chew on her shoes under the couch as we would teach her. And we sat down, and Luetta handed me her blessing, and she said, "I'd like you to read that for me." And I said, "No, Luetta, that's personal. I think you ought to be the first to read it." She goes, "No, please." And again I declined. I said, "Luetta, I think it's between you and the Lord, and you ought to read it first." And her eyes got really big. And for the first time we ever taught her, she called us elders, and she said, "No, elders, you don't understand, do you?" And I said, "I don't understand what, Luetta?" She said, "I don't have eyes to see to read." She said, "My eyes haven't seen words on a written page for over 15 years. But when you gave me that book, I knew it was true because I saw the words. And the Lord granted me that power till I finished its last page. But I don't have that power anymore. Would you please read to me my blessing?" And we just sat there for the longest while, and then finally I started to read to Luetta her blessing, and it was beautiful. I was talking about the sweet elect woman that she was and all that God had planned for her. And I got about 3/4 of the way through it, and I read a line that changed my mission and changed my life. It said that Luetta would have joined the church 25 years earlier if the elder that accepted his call would have went. But he had not, and now 2 other missionaries had been prepared to teach her. And they had proven themselves worthy of that blessing because of some sacrifice and trial on their part. This was the last month of my 6-month extension. I can't imagine what my life would be like if I never met her. And I wish I could tell you that Luetta's story ended there. But it didn't. 5 days later, we dedicated the grave of Luetta Fry. She passed away that night, having completed all that the Lord wanted her to do. One thing we all need to know is that our decision to serve or not to serve affects the salvation of other people. That when the Lord chooses a missionary, he just doesn't say, "Well, the North Carolina Charlotte Mission needs missionaries," or "the Utah Salt Lake South Mission needs missionaries," or "the Iowa Des Moines Mission." He matches your personality, your talents, your gifts with certain people that preside in that mission so that their lives can be touched. Though Elder Ballard was from Pocatello, Idaho, he was serving in Moscow, Idaho, and maybe he didn't know why, but once he taught me, I knew why he was there. It's not happenstance. It's inspiration. The greatest opportunity we have, I believe, in this life is to share the message of the gospel. I've had people tell me, "Oh, Brother Carpenter, you have a wonderful conversion story. I wish I had something like that to tell." And I have but one response to that, and that is, you do. A conversion story doesn't come simply because you joined the church. A conversion story or a conversion is a spiritual witness to the truthfulness of the gospel. You don't have to join the church to be a convert to it. And you shouldn't have to join the church to be a convert to it. We all ought to be. Because you've had experiences in your life that were as difficult for the decisions that I had to make in mine. But you made them. And you made the right choices. And you stood for that which you felt inside of you to be true. That's a conversion. It's not simply joining the church past the age of 8. But a spiritual witness for the member and the non-member alike. I just want you to know that I know that Jesus Christ is our Savior,
that God is his father and my father. That the gospel that we share, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is the truth. It contains all necessary principles for salvation. And the greatest joy that we'll ever have is the sharing of that with other people, as we are soldiers in the army of God, our Father and His Son, Jesus Christ. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.